And Sophie, welcome to the podcast. We need to acknowledge that we're in a new studio, which is really cool. We're recording in a new space. We've got a great big sign behind you that says Talk 20s to me.
It's beautiful.
Yay!
Thank you for having me.
In order to keep bringing you guys tons of free content, we work with brand partners who you'll hear from in this episode, including an advertisement from Zopa Bank.
We're super proud that this podcast is brought to you in partnership with our headline sponsors, Zopa Bank, who are one of the UK's leading digital banks. If you've not heard about Zopa before, they're all about fair, simple, and easy to use financial products. My personal favorite is their Zopa Smart Saver, where you can create personalized pots for your different savings goals. To check them out for yourself, head to your app store and search Zopa, that's Z-O-P-A, and start saving from £1. The interest is payable monthly and is subject to variation.
We always kick off the podcast by asking our guests to look at a picture from this time last year, something you didn't post on social media, or maybe people might not have seen. Have you got a little picture that can show us the behind the scenes of your life? Something that might sum you up a little bit.
Okay. I, for the past few years, haven't posted that much on social media.
Okay. Well, then you had a lot to choose from, right?
Yeah. This time last year was quite a special time for me. Okay. I got engaged.
Congratulations.
So most of my camera roll,
of course, just taking up ring pictures, basically. Yeah.
Basically. And we were in a really beautiful location.
Where was it? So
we were in Saudi Arabia, in Alula.
Wow.
Which they're making this whole new, like,
is it the Mile or something like that they're building in Saudi Arabia?
No, yeah, they're doing that. So that's not where we were.
Okay.
But they're doing a bunch of these projects that just like look absolutely phenomenal.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's just like between like a canyon or something like that.
It's in the middle of the desert. There was nothing there. And they've just built this beautiful place. And there is history to the place. So it's, if you know, in Jordan, they have those like beautiful tombs.
Mm-hmm.
It's said to have been made from the same people who did those in Jordan.
Oh,
so it's, I think, 4 hours from Jordan.
When is the wedding? Have you started planning?
No.
Okay.
I'm a happily engaged woman.
Okay.
And I think I'm just happy here right now.
Just enjoying the engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No plans to get married.
I'll just stay engaged forever.
Right now.
But to be fair, I was similar. Like the first like year of getting engaged, like people would be like, when's the wedding? Yeah. And I'd be like, I'm quite chill. Like,
And then
it got to the point where you're like, oh, we should probably book it now.
Yeah. But you've also been together for 10 years.
Yeah. Long time. So. Very, very long time. How long have you been with your partner?
2 years.
Okay.
And he's gonna love this because I never talk about
him. Ah, yay for the fiance.
I know this is not neuroscience, but I have some really good tips.
Okay, go on. I want to hear them.
We could do a whole nother episode on this. First of all, I think I took a lot of time out of dating to focus on healing and, you know, developing myself in other areas, my friendships, my careers, being close with my family, and just understanding what means the most to me and what I want in my life. And then living a life that was very much in alignment with that. Because it was very clear to me then that either somebody's going to fit in or they're not. And so you can kind of, you know, tell if somebody is going to be a good partner for you or not. And I would also choose somebody who's done the same. So not somebody who's just dating to, you know, get laid or go out and have fun experiences, but somebody who's also in it for something deeper, if that's what you're looking for. But my biggest tip for sure would be not to date.
Not to date at all.
Not to date, actually. Not to drink while
you're dating. Not to drink whilst you're dating.
I think that's a really big one, because if I look back at my 20s when I was dating, I would always go for drinks and, you know, it makes the other person seem a lot funnier than they probably are.
Yeah.
And you don't need to give them that, you know. And then it kind of escalates the intimacy as well. You know, at the end of the night, you know, it might be kissing or it might go further than that. And then you wake up and you're like, okay, well, I've just supercharged that intimacy without really knowing this person. And it kind of leaves you in a very strange place. I feel like dating without drinking is such a good, I mean, it's such a, first of all, you don't wake up with the hangovers. You're not like wasting, you know, your fun nights on random people that you don't know.
We had some guest experts that came on the podcast that have started a dating app, but it's all about increasing connection in person. And they were like, one of the most popular dates that people go on nowadays is like a walk and get a coffee. And I think that's quite a good way, because like obviously if you're, you know, spit active, like you can decide how long that walk is going to be. It could be a really, really long walk, or it could be like, we're just going to do one lap of the park and like, yeah, it's a no from me. But like, you know, there's a lot of people are choosing to date like that. And I think it's, you know, it kind of leans into what you're saying there, which is like choosing an opportunity where, yeah, you're not just absolutely wasting going, you're great. Yeah. You're amazing. Let's talk a little bit about neuroscience, because that is your area of expertise. Why neuroscience? Like, why did that even interest you to want to go into that?
Yeah, I studied psychology and my first neuroscience lecture, so it was like the biological foundation of psychology. It was kind of like a moment for me, because I was studying psychology, and you'll read about all of these studies and people are putting years of effort into developing the study and like finding the results and like reporting on it. And even, you know, once you finish the study, in order to get published, that takes a whole year to, you know, it's just a really long process. And at the end of every single one of those studies, you'll have, this is what we found, but, you know, don't take it too seriously because individual differences. And so everything in psychology is really about individual differences. It's all a huge generalization, but you can't actually make the generalization because people are different. Mm-hmm. And with neuroscience, what I really liked about that was, it's like, here's what's happening in the brain when you're doing this, or when this person is doing this. And it's just a little bit more practical.
If you want to know what we're drinking here in the Talk 20 studio, then let me tell you, because you're going to want to try it. Riviera Iced Tea is the newest sponsor of the Talk 20s podcast. It's low calorie, natural, vegan, and gluten free. I'm absolutely obsessed with iced tea. I've just been laughing here about how obsessed I am with iced tea with our producer. It's my favorite drink in the whole wide world, no exaggeration. And the peach iced tea from Riviera is genuinely the best I've ever tasted. So if you want to fill your fridge with something super refreshing, head to rivieraicedtea.com. or check out their Instagram at Riviera Iced Tea.
You also have like kind of specialized again then into like mental resilience. Mm-hmm. What was the interest in that?
There, I mean, so many things, but one thing in particular, because a lot of mental resilience comes down to mindfulness. Mm-hmm. When I was 14, I was traveling with my best friend at the time. We went to Thailand, and one day we ended up in the middle of nowhere. We went to this Buddhist monastery that was like in a cliff somewhere. We just spent a day there. We were talking to monks and they were telling us about, you know, the way that they live their life. And there was just something really beautiful about the way that they approach life. And I always thought, if I don't get into university, I'll come back here. I'll shave my hair and...
Oh my God, really?
I'll be a monk. And yeah, because it was just, you know, I struggled a lot as well with my mental health. Mm-hmm. And the idea of just like giving away all of my possessions, like letting go of all of that and just trying to be at peace.
There's something quite freeing about it, isn't it?
Yeah, like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Then I went to university. I wasn't particularly happy when I was at university. I was still going through depression. Then it wasn't until I found the studies about putting monks in an MRI machine, where kind of like the mindfulness and the neuroscience intertwined.
Tell me more about that.
Fascinating. They basically took monks, people who had been meditating for years and years and years, in an MRI, because they wanted to see, well, surely their brains must be different.
Yeah, what does it do to the actual brain?
How do their brains look? Or what's going on in the brain when you're meditating? Mm-hmm. One thing that's really interesting is, if you just look at not what's happening inside the brain, but what does a brain look like from somebody who's been meditating for a long time? It looks completely different on the surface. So there's this process called gyrification, which is the process by which the brain creates its folds. So like the sulcus, which is the little valley, and the gyrus, which is like the little hill. So, mm-hmm. you know, those little wrinkles that the brain has. And you'll see in species that are less complex than us as humans, that the brain is a little bit smoother. You also see this in, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome. So if there's been something that's happened to the brain during development, that the brain is a lot smoother. There's not as many grooves. Okay. In people who meditate, there are more grooves. And that's associated with more like higher order cognitive functions. So more complex brains.
So is our brain changing all the time then?
Yeah. Like, so this is what we mean when we say the brain is plastic. Mm-hmm, it's obviously okay. Not made out of plastic. It has the ability to change over time. So we used to think that the brain was pretty static. You know, you are born the way that you are and your brain doesn't change. And, you know, if you're depressed, then you're going to be depressed. If you see things this way, then, you know, that's how it's going to be forever. But we know now that the brain can change, and meditation is a really great way to do that.
It's mad to think that kind of something that feels like it's something that you do that is so mental can actually have a physical effect. Yeah. Like you're talking about the grooves there, like it actually has a, you know, it's about our thoughts and the way we kind of do things, but it's having an impact on actually the, like you said, like the peaks and the troughs in the brain. That is fascinating.
Yeah. So if you think about it, of course the brain changes, because otherwise how might you be able to learn a new language, right? Mm-hmm. Later on in life, the brain has to like create that pathway and make those connections. And so the more those connections are reinforced, the more that you're practicing this language or piano or whatever other skill it is, the more that those pathways are connecting and that brain area then develops. So that's something that you might then have in a piano player that they didn't have before. So the brain, of course, has to change.
And you use a method that has like six components towards kind of mental fitness and stuff. We're going to talk through some of them today, because I think it's really interesting. And you use the IR6 model. Tell us a little bit more about that. Tell us more about the science behind it.
Yeah. So of course, my interest into resilience came from a lot of my personal experiences, and then also being really interested in meditation, working a lot in the mental health tech space. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to look at, well, how do you actually measure resilience? Something that's so abstract. And you hear a lot of people talking about, you know, being resilient. How do you measure that in the neuroscientific literature? And there are a lot of different models. The IR6 is one of them. There's also the resilience quotient. That also has six elements. And, you know, to make things not so complex, I'll just go with the first one. But all of those six elements kind of relate to other ones. Mm-hmm. So other models that you might see. So I'm not saying that this is like the only one or the only way that you measure it, but it's very well versed in the literature. And it measures, so these six different areas, and we'll go through them pretty quickly. The first one is vision. Mm-hmm. So this is the vision that you have for your life. Are you clear on what that is? Like, what are you working towards? Mm-hmm. Tenacity is another one, and that's just, you know, pushing through. Composure is your ability to, you know, self-regulate. Then you have reasoning. So again, your ability to introspect and to plan forward for the future. Health is one of them, of course, because your health plays a big part in your ability to be resilient. And what I look at here for the most part is sleep. I'm not going to go too much into, you know, nutrition or exercise, more your relation to those things rather than actually like trying to figure out with you what you need to be eating or how often you need to be exercising. But again, in the wellness space right now, you see a lot of what borders on orthorexia, which is, you know, where you're very obsessed with just eating clean or like sticking to certain protocols that apparently you need to be doing, like delaying caffeine intake. And yeah, it can kind of get borderline unhealthy. Then the last area would be collaboration. So if I work in a corporate setting with this as well. And so if you're, you know, working corporate, I might look at teamwork, you know, how are you with your coworkers? But collaboration is just all about your relationships, your friendships, your ability to maintain friendships, to nurture friendships, the support that you have. And again, when we look at a lot of longevity research, which is also like very popular right now, you know, how can we live longer?
Yeah, how can we live to 100?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're looking, people are thinking, you know, nutrition, like what are people eating in the blue zones or whatever? But a lot of research is coming out as well that shows that the quality of your relationships, the support that you have, is a key indicator of how long you're going to live. For all of these areas, like the ways that you can work on them all boil down to obviously mindfulness And then there's kind of different forms of mindfulness and exercises like breath work, visualization, even positive affirmations. And I know to some people that sounds kind of like airy-fairy, journaling, but and gratitude. You can use these techniques in all of those areas. For vision, I might say we could start with visualization, for example. So if you're someone who doesn't really have a clear direction on where your life is going or what you want or what your goals are, you can start to do that through visualizing yourself like 5, 10, 20 years into the future. And the reason why this is such a powerful technique, and it doesn't work for everyone, so there are some people who can't voluntarily bring up images, but that's a very small percentage of the population, so it should be fine. Mm-hmm. But the first step is to become a little bit more mindful, so to breathe deeply, activate your parasympathetic nervous system so that your body feels safe and relaxed, and then bring to mind yourself, let's say, 10 years into the future. And you might struggle to have that vision at first, but the more you do it, the more clarity that you get. And you can say, okay, I want to focus specifically on where my career will be. So imagine yourself then in your work setting. What does your office look like? What clothes are you wearing? What does that say about you? Who's around you? And then if you really focus in on the five senses to get that like crystal clear image. Mm. So what does it smell like in the room? You know, am I outside? Am I inside? What can I hear around me? What are people saying? Are they giving me praise? Like maybe I'm on a stage and people are clapping, right? Or maybe I'm in the boardroom and people are like praising my idea. Just focusing as much as possible on all of the details and then bringing some emotion into that. How does that make me feel? How do I feel being on stage? You know, am I invigorated? Do I feel calm? Do I feel confident? Do I feel proud? And what you're doing when you're visualizing, and it seems so simple, but it's so powerful, is you're actually flooding your body with all of those hormones and all of those positive like endorphins. So you're already experiencing what it would be like. And that brings you one step closer, right? So you're already able to have that experience before it's even happened. Your body feels like it's possible. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I think, a very powerful way to get, first of all, clarity on where you want to go, but then also break down those barriers of, you know, this is possible for me.
I think a lot of people will go, oh, this is like too woo-woo for me. Like there's too many things going on, or like, you know, this is, you know, what's the science behind it? But I think obviously you've just broken down that there's a lot of stuff that I see going around that's like manifest your dream life. Yeah. Like, is that actually possible? Like, can you, like, is that actually what's going on in your brain that it, you know, manifesting does help?
So this is really interesting from my scientific perspective. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like a lot of people who talk about manifestation, they talk about you can just talk or like want something into existence. Mm-hmm. But it's not so much about that as it is about goal setting. And the clearer you get on those goals and the more you commit to doing things like, you know, you can manifest through affirmations, visualization, like all of these things that I've spoken about. But if you use them day in, day out, the reason why it can work is because you are essentially setting a goal. You're reminding yourself every day that this is what you're working towards. So then your brain is already primed to look out for situations or decisions that might be in line with that, right? Rather than somebody who will say at the beginning of the year, okay, New Year's resolution, I want to get in the best shape of my life, and then forget about it, and mm-hmm. then it never happens. So you could kind of see it that way, right? If somebody is manifesting it, and they're committed to manifesting it, they're thinking about it every day, they're looking out for that, they're feeling the experience before they've experienced it, it just seems much more feasible. And then your brain, of course, is like, well, of course this could work out for me. And of course I'm already that person that I strive to be.
Mm-hmm. And we just chatted through vision there. Like what's when it comes to composure, how are we looking at improving composure in our lives?
Yeah, so very simple. Again, you can use any of these techniques. Mm-hmm. But I'll talk here about meditation, for example, because that's such a easy way to just regain your composure when you meditate. And meditation isn't, you know, sitting somewhere and not thinking of anything and clearing your brain of all thoughts. It's, in its simplest form, just being very present and aware of the moment without any judgment. So a way that you can do that is sit and follow your breath. So just like follow every inhale, follow every exhale, because when you're breathing, you're not in the past or in the future. You're just breathing right here, right now. So it kind of forces you to be in the present moment. Essentially, what happens is if you practice this, you are training your brain out of these pathways that are usually active to be more attuned to what's happening right here, right now. And most likely what's happening right here, right now isn't threatening. It isn't, you know, when you're worried, you're thinking about something that might happen in the future. And so, again, same principles with the visualization. Your body is flooding with these feelings saying, well, you know, that outcome that you're thinking about, that's so awful. And I need to be prepared. I need to like increase my heart rate, dilate the pupils, you know, get the muscles primed, like everything is getting prepared to like bounce. It's your cortisol activation, you know, the fight or flight. And this is based on just a thought that you're having. So again, you come back into the present moment, you realize that I'm not thinking about anything. I'm not worrying about anything. I'm here right now. There's no threat. And you basically train a new pathway that allows you to be in this present moment for longer. So you are then more regulated as a person, more composed, because you're just here. Like, mm-hmm. It's just me and you. There's no threat. There's no worries. It's just the present.
Mm-hmm. The next one on the list is reasoning. How would you improve your reasoning for improving your mental fitness?
So I would say, again, this is a really good one for meditation. And I'm going to say meditation and mindfulness is not entirely the same thing. Mindfulness is just the act of being present and aware. Meditation is the practice that you do to help you get there. But again, it's a practice that can help you with your reasoning, because it allows you to not be so reactive to, you know, if you said something to me, like, I don't know, criticized me, then my amygdala would like flare up and I'd be looking out and constantly searching for any other proof that you're a threat to me. Mm-hmm. And it might affect the way that I behave, the decisions that I make, or how I feel, how I treat you. You know, maybe I'll be like a little bit feisty. Maybe I'll like say something back. Or maybe I'll make just a bad decision, you know, say something stupid on this podcast that's going to like tear up my career. But again, if you're practicing meditation and you're practicing being mindful, then you actually can dampen that amygdala response. You can dampen those pathways as you're working on the pathways that are more steady, more present, and more helpful to you. So you're not as emotionally activated. You're not like making decisions based on emotions. You're, again, just a little bit more settled.
I think it's really hard, like when you're stepping out into adult life and you're trying to learn how to navigate life in general, it can be really tricky. I think a lot of young people, the ones that I see doing kind of, I don't know, what would you describe as successful? But, you know, the people who I appear to be successful, I just think they're tenacious. They just have mm-hmm. something that maybe the rest of us don't have. And they're just like so hard, like they're in the pursuit of their goals. Is that something that you're born with, or is that something that you can grow over time?
You can absolutely grow that. And it's very much about mindset. But when you become more confident with yourself, when you can train your brain to be more in the present moment, then you know that, you know, you're not taking things in such a negative way all the time. You can see something as like a bit of a setback, but you have enough confidence in yourself to push through, to get over it. And especially if you have your vision, right? And that area of your life is crystal clear. You know that sometimes things are going to happen. You're going to get rejected. You're going to get some no's, but it's not, you know, stopping you from getting to where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And you just look back at your vision. You know, maybe you're visualizing, you set that goal again and you're like, no, I can do this. And this setback is, this is nothing.
Because I think it's really hard to, like, especially with like the whole resilience side of things, to kind of pick yourself back up when you get no's. Like, how can we, apart from like the vision and stuff like that, how can we continuously like improve on that to become more tenacious?
Again, and I'm probably going to say this
for
all of them.
She's going to say it's meditation, everyone.
but all of them, like, yeah. Meditation, yeah, of course. But let's talk about another one. For example, positive affirmations.
Yeah.
Which, again, to a lot of people sounds like airy-fairy, woo-woo stuff. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, you probably have some intrinsic beliefs that, you know, when you were younger, you heard someone, maybe your teacher said that you were lazy. And now your whole life, you have this complex, I'm lazy. Mm-hmm. And if something doesn't go right or you're not progressing in work, you're like, well, it's because I'm lazy and fundamentally there's something wrong with me. But is what they said true? Or is it just, you know, something that you've heard repeatedly or told yourself repeatedly and now your brain perceives it as true? Because that's how the brain works. The most salient information, what it hears the most, is what it perceives as true. So if you now step back and say positive affirmations about yourself or your abilities, and you might say, I'm confident, I'm able, I'm, you know, beautiful, even whatever it is, the more you say that, the more your brain perceives that as true. And it's not tricking your brain. It's just, that's how it works. That's, you know, that's how, that's neuroplasticity.
So again, you think that the confident people that we're seeing, like walk into a room and they're like, you know, they think they look good, or they do look good. Mm. They believe they look good, or they are confident on stage. Like, are they doing something different to the rest of us?
I think it can be a mix of having worked on that sense of self, mm-hmm. and like having worked on like those limiting beliefs that they might have had. And then it could also be just, you know, on the other side of it, just knowing that things are always going to be okay anyway. Mm-hmm. And that it's not the end of the world. So, like, not catastrophizing things. That's something
we're also guilty of that in our 20s. We do just think, like, the worst is going to happen. Yeah. And a lot of people think, like, oh, if I haven't... And I think this comes down to, like, the idea of, like, a lot of people get stressed about reaching 30. Because they're like, I have to have done everything by the time I reach 30.
Yeah.
And they, like, it's the end of the world if that happens. Like, there are probably, like, 40, 50 more years after that. But everyone puts so much pressure on that first decade of their life to have everything, like, figured out.
I'm 29.
Yeah.
So, like, it is kind of... Also, for me, I look at it like, okay, well, in the past, I might have been like, these are all the things that I need to achieve before I'm 30. But right now, the way that I look at things, and this is after having meditated for years and years and years and, you know, working on those areas of mental resilience... I know that I'm where I'm supposed to be right now. I look back at who I was and I'm like, as that version of myself, you know, it wouldn't have been right for me to be in that position or doing that or getting married or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything has its time.
And you mentioned about collaboration, about how important it is that the people that we surround ourselves can actually improve like our life span. What's the science behind that? What are the studies that have been done? Because I find that fascinating.
Yeah, there are studies that have shown that, well, if you're going through something really difficult, like let's say a mental health episode or losing your job or whatever, it's being able to have people around you who support you, who lift you up again, who make everything kind of like relative to the situation. That helps you so much with your mental health because you're like, do you know what? It's not so bad. Like here I am having dinner and having fun with the people around me whom I love and they love me regardless of what's going on with my job. Because I think a lot of the time people focus so much on, you know, my sense of self-worth comes from how much money I earn or my job title or whatever. But when you're around good people who support you, none of that really matters, right? Mm-hmm. But there have been studies as well that show like if you're around couples who get divorced, you're more likely to get divorced. Like really? If you're around couples who are very unhealthy, you're more likely to be unhealthy. So it's really about, you know, it does affect you, like the people that are around you and how they see the world and how they treat their health.
And so does that have like an impact genuinely like on the brain, like the people that we surround ourselves with? Like can that actually have like a physical or mental impact?
Yeah. And think about it. how do you feel when you're around somebody who's constantly negative?
Negative. Literally, I try and not surround myself with people like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then if you think about what I'm saying about neuroplasticity, or, you know, what the brain hears the most becomes the most true. And those pathways are then getting stronger and developing. So if you're around somebody who's always judging, criticizing, ungrateful, mm-hmm. then you're also more likely to think that way, because that's what you're seeing. That's your truth. That's what you're believing. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of work to kind of counteract that. So I have a very strong stance on this in personal work that I do, like with people. In your personal life, I feel like everybody probably has a person that they might need to distance themselves from a little bit, because we're also creatures of habit. So we don't like to, you know, have friendship breakups or things like that if we don't have to. Mm-hmm. We have friends that have been friends for a long period of time and we've changed and we notice that, you know, things aren't as they used to be. They're sucking all of the energy out of you. They don't believe in you. And it's just kind of like a negative environment. But we don't want to have to make those decisions if we don't really have to do it. Mm-hmm. But I'm a firm believer that, you know, if there's somebody that comes to mind when you're listening to this, see if maybe there's a gentle way that you can distance yourself. Mm-hmm.
Wise words. Mm-hmm. The last one is health. And I'm actually quite interested in hearing more about sleep and how that affects us and how that impacts the brain as well. Can you tell me more about it?
Yeah, I my last position was chief science officer of a sleep app, so I can...
Oh, you're gonna be able to tell me so much about sleep. So what should we be doing with sleep? Like, is 8 hours a day how long we should be sleeping?
So I love that question because there is no magic number
okay. For
anything. There is a range, you know, anywhere from 6 to 9 hours is okay. Mm-hmm. I would say the reason why the length of your sleep is important is because if you're sleeping too long, it could signify that there's something wrong with your health in other ways, or mm-hmm. could be an indicator of like depression or something like that. So you should definitely speak to somebody about that if you're sleeping like 12 hours or, you mm-hmm. know. Again, on the lower end of things, You should really be sleeping 6 hours or more, just because there are so many beneficial things that happen for your brain and body when you sleep. And you're putting yourself at risk of like cardiovascular problems, weight gain even, you know, can happen if you're sleep deprived, just increased stress. So many things. But some people, and we all know these people who are like, well, I sleep 5 hours and that's all I need. Mm-hmm. You know yourself best. If you sleep well on like 7 hours, get 7 hours. But if you sleep well on like 9 hours, for example, I sleep like on the like longer end of side. So mm-hmm. I'll sleep like 9, sometimes 10 hours. Mm-hmm. That's fine. I've been told. But if you're somebody who's like, yeah, I definitely need only 5 hours of sleep, like I would please urge you to sleep a little bit longer, just because
What's happened to our brain during that time though?
During that time,
yeah, when we're sleeping.
So your brain actually cleans itself during sleep. So cerebrospinal fluid comes into your brain and flushes out all of the toxins. And there's a really interesting new study that's actually come out recently this month that shows a little bit more on how that happens. And it's the fluid is synchronized by the brain waves. So as you know, when you go through different phases of sleep, there's different brain waves associated with that. And you have like these slower brain waves. And when the fluid comes into the brain, it's almost being like directed by those brain waves. So if you think about your brain being cleaned like cleaning a plate, for example, you have these big movements to get the bulk of the dirt out of it. Mm-hmm. And then when you go into a different stage of sleep, which is associated with like more high frequency brain waves, that fluid is kind of like, you know, you're kind of like scrubbing. It's like you have a little piece of dirt or something that you kind of need to get off. So that's how the researchers described it. But yeah, your brain cleans itself of toxins, and that's why sleep is associated with things like neurodegenerative diseases.
And so I'm guessing if you're going without sleep for long periods of time, or you're not having enough sleep, there is not enough time for that cleaning to
exactly,
take place.
And to
then,
happen.
Then what happens over time, like over a long period of time, if that's like a continuous thing for one night, I'm sure it's okay, but yeah. you probably
well,
will
so
feel it.
One night of being sleep deprived will actually impact your cognitive function. So in the same way that being like a little bit tipsy would. So you shouldn't technically sleep or you shouldn't technically be allowed to drive your car if you're sleep deprived, because it's the same as like having had two or three beers.
Oh my gosh.
Also
I've
what
definitely,
happens
but I can relate like there's yeah. definitely been times where I've woken up and I've like I'm on like so little sleep and I am like yeah. I'm not fully with it like
but
I
feel
can't.
Like so many people are like yeah. oh you know just pulled an all-nighter it's fine I'll just get over it but
yeah
but yeah obviously the long-term impact is a lot worse but mm-hmm. there's so much that already happens just with one night of being sleep deprived apparently in one study being sleep deprived for one night would be associated with an increased caloric intake of like 300 to 1,000 more calories the next day.
Because you're so tired and you just want to eat more food.
Well, because, yeah, it regulates certain hormones. Like ghrelin is one of them. Leptin is another one. That those are signals to you that I need to like eat. For example, like if you're delaying going to sleep, you're up maybe watching Netflix, one of those hormones that's secreted in the stomach. Which usually goes down. So this is ghrelin. It usually goes down. It goes up right before you eat. So this is associated with the motivation to eat. Then once you've eaten, it goes down. When you're sleeping, it goes down even more because when you're sleeping, your body isn't expending as much energy. So your body doesn't need to be eating more calories. But if you're staying awake, then that hormone ghrelin goes up again. And it's telling your body, well, I'm staying awake. Surely I should be eating more calories, even though you probably don't need to be eating more calories. So then you have that feeling of like hunger. That's why a lot of people get like nighttime mm-hmm. Hunger. And yeah, that happens. And you're also more likely to eat salty and fatty foods, and fats obviously have more calories per gram. Mm-hmm. So you can just accidentally basically...
So moral of the story is we all need to sleep more and like a good amount of time.
Yeah, yeah. A good amount of time. And mm-hmm. yeah, if this happens over a long period of time, then, you know, heart disease, Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. all of those things, you could be at increased risk.
And I'm really interested to understand more about the brain in our 20s. Like, what is happening? Is it different to any other age? Because obviously once we, you know, when we grow up, there's so many things happening to our brain, like in the developmental stages. At what point does it like stop growing, or does it just continue forever?
So it's really interesting that you said that, because yesterday I saw on quite a popular like pop psychology account, I'm not going to name any names, but a video where he said, I read this study that said that your brain is still finishes developing when you're 25. And so then he went on to like talk about what that meant and mm-hmm. what he was thinking. I was thinking, I know that you haven't read that study. Because there is no study that says at 25, this is what happens in the brain. There's nothing magical about the number 25. Most of the studies that look into this have been kind of misconstrued or misinterpreted, and, you know, make their way into like pop psychology. Mm-hmm. What they will show is that your brain continues developing after the ages of like 20, like well into your 20s. And that's something, again, that we didn't realize beforehand, because you would think that the brain is just finished developing, you know, when you're an adult and that's fine, you're 18 and like mm-hmm. all of those things stop. And that's not true. The brain can continue developing. And we've spoken about this briefly before, but if you have ADHD, for example, which we both have, it could be, you know, you could be developing way past that into, you know, your 30s.
So your ADHD brain develops at a slower rate, or it just develops in a different way?
Yeah. So what the theory behind that is that the way that the ADHD brain develops is that the prefrontal cortex, so where all of the executive functionings are happening, it just takes longer to develop and it's fully formed a little bit later, which is why a lot of symptoms can kind of disappear mm-hmm. into adulthood.
So interesting. Honestly, I feel like I've learned so much that my brain hurts because there's so much knowledge that has come in about the brain and how it works. But
I
hopefully,
didn't want to do that.
No, no, in a good way. It hurts in a good way. Like, I need to know more about this stuff, because this, I never learned this stuff in school. I don't think any of us listening right now,
we don't
learn this stuff. But it is really interesting. We all have a brain. This is helpful information for everyone.
Yeah.
So it has been really, really interesting to have this chat with you and kind of dive into a little bit more about the neuroscience behind, you know, becoming mentally fit as well. We like to chat a little bit more about people's 20s on the podcast towards the end of our podcast. And we like to know people's biggest adulting failures. So the things that you might not want to take them back, because they might have got you where you are today, but the things that you really slipped up on, like, we all make mistakes. And I think, yes, you know, they might be good things later down the line, but what are the things that you look back on and like, I cannot believe that I did that? Is there something that springs to mind?
There is something that springs to mind. But again, the way that I look at things is like, it's not a failure. It's, you know, I learned something. And also, it's not, I can't believe I did that. It's more like, of course, you know.
of course I did that. Go on, tell us a story.
So I was working at one of the jobs. I'm not going to say who. They were a great company. And I remember going in and thinking, I need to negotiate my salary contract, because I was listening to loads of podcasts about women in this space, and that a big part of the gender pay gap is that women don't actually negotiate their salaries as much. That's like one of the main things, is that they just kind of accept what they're given. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go in and I'm going to negotiate my salary. And I felt so good about it. I was like, look at me. This is like the first time that I'm getting offered this much money. I'm going to negotiate my salary even higher. You know, my parents couldn't even believe that I was earning. You should be happy with that. You know, that's a pretty good salary. I'm like, okay, I'm still going to do it because I just have to. And I went in and I negotiated my salary. And they said, no. And I'm like, okay, well, I wasn't prepared for a no. And so I was like, well,
that's not what the podcast says. That's
not what was supposed to happen.
They just say that you say,
yeah.
What do I do now? Okay.
And then I was like, okay, well, cool. Maybe I can negotiate more shares. Or, you know, if you can't negotiate on salary, if they're not going to give you more money, then maybe you can negotiate on some like lifestyle factors. So these days that could be like working more days from home or, you know, having other sort of benefits. So I negotiated more shares and I was like, cool, pretty proud of that. You know, we were a startup, so great thing to have. I was the head of my department. And a few months down the line, they brought in someone who was working for me, essentially, one day a week. A guy who had been working in the industry for like a year at the time. He's great. And this is nothing about him. I think the work that he does is great and he's still a good friend of mine. But I found out that he was earning £20,000 more than me and he was coming in one day a week in his contract. And technically, I was the head of the department. So, yeah, I still feel uneasy thinking about that. And I was really made to feel... I was made to feel really bad bringing it up because, again, I did... bring it up and I never wanted to be like, he's earning this and I should be earning this much. I made it about myself again. This is what I'd learned from my podcast is focus on what you bring to the table. I'm like, these are the degrees that I have. This is the specialty. This is how many years I've been working in this industry. I'm the head of the department. This is how many hours that I put in. I made it all about me. And my boss came back to me and he was like, it sounds like you have a chip on your shoulder.
And if you could look back now, how would you have approached that situation?
I would have left. I had some great opportunities from there, but I spoke to my grandmother about this and she's like, if you try and renegotiate your salary and they say no, you have to be prepared to leave and walk away.
And did you try and renegotiate again?
I did try and renegotiate because when I brought this up, I, you know, focused on all of the benefits of me as a person and, and my qualifications and my experience. That didn't work out in the end anyway. So I don't know if what I would have done if I would have left, if I would have been prepared for that, but, but yeah, if that ever happens again, I'm 100% leaving.
One of the things that we like to talk about on the podcast as well is obviously you have come so far in your career and in neuroscience as well. And you know so much about the brain that it hurts my brain as well, what I was saying beforehand. But we know that from chatting to everyone that comes on the podcast that no one's perfect. Everyone is working through something in their life. So whilst you might have a really good understanding of the brain, I'm sure there's parts of your life that you're like, I don't know much about and I would like to learn more about. For you, what is that area that you're kind of working on?
Yeah. there are loads of things that I'm working on. Something that comes to mind though is ADHD. Mm-hmm. I was diagnosed 6 years ago, I think, and I've learned so much in the meantime. And there's always so many tips and tricks about how to make your life a little bit easier mm-hmm. with ADHD, because a lot of the, you know, self-help stuff or time management techniques that you hear about don't apply to us. Yeah. So you have to really find your way. And obviously I know people are, it takes a long time to get a diagnosis. And before I got the diagnosis, I didn't even have a clue about ADHD. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd briefly learned about it when I was doing my bachelor's, but not, we had no understanding the way that we do now. So I wasn't aware that that would be something that I would be diagnosed with. It mm-hmm. came as a complete shock to me, and it's been a learning curve for sure. And what's helped the most, I have to say, is having a partner who also educates themselves mm-hmm. on that, and who can like understand when your behaviors or your attitudes are, you know, the ADHD or when they're you. So
mm-hmm. And what are the biggest things that you've kind of changed in your life in those 6 years then that have helped you with your ADHD? Like, are there any ones that you can share for people who are maybe more recently diagnosed? Because I'm like, it's June last year, so coming really? Up for a year now. So, wow. Yeah.
I would say, you know, the internet has been really helpful, and all of these like videos of people. And the best tips and tricks that I've learned are really the most abstract ones. Mm-hmm. Like, if you have things to do, you're coming home and you've got things to do, don't take your shoes off, because taking your shoes off will signal to you that, like, you know, your work is done, you're relaxing, mm-hmm. you know, get cozy. And so if you have things to do,
good point, actually, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially for me, because I don't like to leave the house. I know I sound like mm-hmm. such a hermit. I am. But leaving the house like multiple times, like going and doing something, running an errand and coming back and then going out and doing something else, is like a complete horror nightmare for me. Mm-hmm. I need to kind of get everything done in one journey. So yeah, not taking my shoes off if I know that I have any work to do, even if it's at home or if I have to leave the house again.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good one. I think for me, the latest one that has been helping me is, like, my to-do list is never ending, right? But I always try and write out my to-do list in the day, like, you know, at the beginning of the day, what I need to get done. And I'm not, you know, loads of people are going to try time blocking, try and do this. Yeah. Nothing really has ever really worked. Like, I like to pick off my to-do list what I want to do. But sometimes that means that, like, I maybe am optimistic about how long I think things are going to take. And I probably put too much on my plate. So I've just started the simplest thing, which is like writing down what I need to do. So it could be like, pick up this from the shop, or it could be send this email. And right next to it, I will write how long in minutes I think that should take. So if it's a 5 minute job, I will write 5 in a little circle. If it's going to be like an hour, they're just going to take me to do that. If I have to be realistic about it, I then put like 60, because that's 60 mm-hmm. minutes. And it makes me look at it and go, okay, like, that's a job that's actually going to take me a long time, so I should maybe do that right now because I've got an hour's gap. Or let me take off all the things that are like 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that has honestly helped me be so much more productive. I've only recently started doing it, maybe like 4 weeks, but I've got so much done, like, in that time. So I think it's just because, like, time blindness is a whole yes. part of ADHD, which, yeah, I didn't realize was a thing, because I thought everyone was rubbish with time. My whole family is rubbish
Same.
With time.
I just thought.
And I was just like, okay, like, that's just how it is.
But surprise, your whole family has
yeah,
ADHD.
Yeah, surprise, everyone. Well, we always ask our guests to close off the podcast what one thing they would tell to their 20-year-old self, one piece of advice that would see them through their 20s. If you could look back at 20-year-old Anne Sophie and give her just one piece of advice, what would you want to say to her?
Well, the first question is, would she listen?
That is a great question. And no one's ever said that, to be fair, because my 20-year-old self would not listen
to
me.
She would not listen. No. She wouldn't listen. But if I could get into her head, if mm-hmm. I could shake her mm-hmm. and tell her something, I think the most important thing that I would want to tell her is that the people who are telling you what to do with your life, what not to do, who to be, what to believe, they might sound believable because they're authority figures, you know, they're adults. Listen to yourself. Try to work on understanding who you are and what means something to you, and trust yourself. Know that you will figure out the right way.
Mm-hmm.
I think so many people, like, if I think about a lot of the people that I speak to nowadays, not you obviously, but like, you know, people that you just encounter in everyday life, and they have all these thoughts and beliefs and judgments about, you know, imagine if you said that I want to do a podcast, people are just going to bring you down. They're going to be like, that's not a real job, or that's not, you know, you're not going to find success
doing
that. Many
people have told me that, right? In the past. It's not a real
and
job.
Look at
How do you make money from that? I'm like, watch me.
But exactly. But look at you. And I think I was too hung up on, you know, other people's beliefs. Like I used to be a ballerina, so I danced pre-professionally.
Wow.
And I got accepted into the Royal Ballet School in Vienna. Mm-hmm. And part of the interviewing process was to bring my whole family so that they could judge how tall everybody is to see whether or not I would be, you know, too tall to be a prima ballerina. My whole family is tall. I have not grown an inch since that day. And they said to me that, you know, you're accepted, but you'll never be the prima ballerina. You'll never be the primary dancer because you're going to be too tall to dance with a man. And so I didn't go. I just changed. I was like, cool, I'll focus on academia. And I've made too many decisions that have just been like, somebody said something and I'm like, wow. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to look at somewhere else. And that is not, yeah. I mean, I am where I needed to end up, mm-hmm. and it's all fine. And I'm not saying that that would have been a better life for me, but I just, yeah, too many decisions made on the judgments of other people.
Thank you so much. It's been so amazing to have in your podcast. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please make sure you hit that subscribe button and come back next week for another episode of the Talk 20s podcast.